any minute. Okay, we're on the Gemara Sanhedrin, Chof Dalet Amud Aleph, 24a. We're just ending up a little bit more. I got it to Gemara. If you recall, the last couple lines we're discussing the differences between the scholars of the land of Israel and the scholars of Bavel. We said that the scholars of the land of Israel were fairly pleasant with each other, while the scholars in Bavel were very hard on each other. They would argue a lot in halacha and things like that. So, and they got that from they show hints to that in various psukim in the Navi. So we're going to give another few psukim to hint to that idea. So on the words va'esa einai, which is, I think that's where we're at. Right, it's after the zaysim. Right after work his eyes. Okay, so the Navi goes on. The Navi Zechariah says, "Va'esa einai." Then I lifted up my eyes, va'ira, and I saw. V'hine shtayim nashim yotzos. Behold, two women came out. V'ruach bechafnehem, and wind was in their wings. V'lohena chinafayim. And they had wings, kekanfei hachasida, like the wings of the chasida bird. Vatisena es ha'efa, and they lifted up the efa measure, bein ha'aretz bein ha'shamayim, between the heaven and the earth. So what does all that mean? Well, it's just going to keep talking. The Navi goes on. Va'omar el ha'melech, and I said to the angel, hadover bi, that spoke with me, Ana hema holichas seifa. Where are they taking the eifa, this dirt? Vayomerle said to me, leave no sla bias bear Shinar. Said to build a house in the land of Shinar. Okay, so what is all that going on over there? So it's imagery of these birds with their wings taking up dirt from Eretz Yisrael, and they're taking it to the land of Shinar, which is Bavel. So what's going on over there? Zomer Rabbi Yochanan, Rishim Bar Yochai. Rabbi Yochanan said the name of Rishim Bar Yochai. What did they take with them? So these women represent the traits of Zu Chanufa. This is Chanufa means to be machanef people, to flatter, insincere flattery. Vigasas Haruach, and arrogance. Shiordel Bavel, that descended to Bavel. Okay? So look at the commentary. The identities of the two women are hinted at Zechariah's description of them. They had wind in their wings, meaning they were puffed up and arrogant. Additionally, their wings resembled those of a chasida bird. What do we know about the chasida bird?
Not kosher.
Well, it's not kosher, but they make externally look like they're pious. Okay? So the women bore the evil inclination of these two traits, represented as being held in the Eifa measure, and set it down in the land of Shinar, otherwise known as Babylonia. So it says, it seems that there's arrogance in Bava, to which the Gemara asks, Vigasu saruach lebavel nachisa, indeed did arrogance descend down to Bava? Wait a minute. Vamar Mar, the master said, Asara gavi kavin gasus yordu lo'oilom, there were 10 measures of arrogance that came into the world. Tisha notla ilaim. Ilaim, which is another name for Persia, took 9 of those portions. Va'achas kolam kula, and one for the rest of the world. So it's clear, if you want to know who's got the arrogance, it's the land of Ilaim and not the land of Babel. So what do you tell me there's so much arrogance over there? Some more answers. Ain, true, Lavavel Nichas, it originally went to Bavel. And then, remember, Bavel got conquered. V'ir shtavuve di ishtar v'vlilim, it subsequently moved to Elam, which was Persia. And Persia conquered Bavel. So there was, and initially, there was arrogance in Bavel. De Kanami, and it also makes sense in the Pasuk. If you look exactly at the reading of the Pasuk, to receive it says, what did it mean? Leave Nosla base be'eret Shinar, to build it in a house, to build in it a house in the land of Shinar. So look at the commentary. The singular it indicates that only one of the women settled in Babylonia, while the other women eventually left. Shmamina, so we see from that while there was, so although the Chanufa stayed in Babylonia, but the arrogance moved to Elam. Okay, 1 minute, 1 second. V'amar, wait a minute, the Gemara asked, V'amar Mar, but the master said, Simon Lagasas Ruach, how can you show there's an indication a fellow is arrogant? Anius is poverty. Okay, and Vanius Labovel Nachis, and poverty descended to Babylonia? Aha, so you see, since poverty was widespread in Babylonia, it would seem that its citizens did possess the trait of arrogance, and it didn't go to Elam. Whereas we start off by saying it first was in Babylon, then went to Elam, but we see that the Jews are very poor in Babylonia. The Gemara in Kiddushin says, 10 kavim of poverty is sent to the world, and Babylon took 9 of them. So they got a lot of poverty. So what's going on over there? So you know what the Gemara... One second. So Gemara answers, my Anius, what type of poverty is indicative of arrogance? Anius Torah, the poverty of knowledge. So that's what it means. So therefore, even though in Bavel they didn't have that kind of arrogance, they didn't have that arrogance anymore, so they didn't have the poverty we're talking about. We thought poverty comes out of real physical poverty comes out of ignorance. We're saying, no, poverty of Torah comes. So that they did not have in Babel. Dichsivan, how do I know that poverty of Torah knowledge comes out of arrogance? Dichsiv, because it says in Shir HaShirim, Achos Lanu, we have a sister, Ketana, young sister, Vishadayim Einlo, and she's not fully developed. Omar, Rav Yochanan says, what's that a hint to? Zu Elam, this is the area of Elam. Shezochsa lilmod velo zochsa lalamod, that merited to learn Torah, did not merit to teach Torah. In contrast to Bavel, where they succeeded in learning Torah and teaching Torah, and this is hinted to in their name. In other words, look at the commentary, the Jews of Elam did not study so well, and Daniel and Mordechai were therefore unsuccessful in their attempts at spreading Torah knowledge there. They are likened to mothers who lack breasts and cannot suckle their young. On the other hand, Ezra in Babylonia succeeded in teaching Torah to the masses spread there. Thus, although the Jews of Babylonia were poor in the material sense, they're wealthy in Torah knowledge. The Jews of Elam, on the other hand, were impoverished when it came to Torah, and this is symptomatic of their arrogance. Good. Now, while we're on the topic, what does the word Bavel mean? My Bavel, what does Bavel allude to? And now you're going to see, Amar Rabbi Yochanan says, Blula means saturated. Bavel, Balal, Blula, saturated, Bamikra, with Psuk, Bechumish, Blula, Bamishna, saturated with Mishnayas, Blula, Batalmud, saturated with Talmud. Okay, look at the commentary. Bavel, the Hebrew name for Babylonia, is etymologically similar to the word balal, or blula, which means saturated. Ola mincha blula b'shemen, saturated with oil. The elucidation follows Yad Ramah. However, others take the word blula to mean mixed up or confused, and understands this a criticism of the method of instruction in Babylonia. In other words, Torah was taught in a jumble there, rather than having the students systematically master scripture first, the Mishnah, finally Talmud. According to this explanation, the connection to scriptural expression that follows is more readily apparent. Okay, so you have two explanations of Bavel, but here, here it's clear, Blula means saturated. Okay, now, the Gemara goes back to its criticism of the students in Bavel. The Pasuk says in Eicha, B'machashakim Hoshivani. Hoshivani has placed me, B'machashakim, in darkness, Kimese Olam, like the eternal dead. What's that? Omer Reb Yirmiya, Zeh Talmud Shel Bavel. This is the Babylonian Torah. Talmud. Why? So they had such rivalry amongst the scholars, so the conclusions never, they never came to conclusions, and they always came out, Bavel also means to be confused. So they came out confused. And when you learn Gemara, right, you're always confused. What's going on? What's the ending? I don't know. That's part of what it's all about. That's part of the Torah of Bavel. That's reflective of what life is. It is quite confusing. Okay, that's the end of the Agadata. We start a brand new Mishnah, and this Mishnah has already been referenced in the Sugya last week, And it's a little bit, a lot of opinions here. So I even had to write notes yesterday so I could get it straight in my mind. Too bad I can't put them up on the board. But we'll take it slowly over here. If you recall, we were talking in some of the machlokas, seeing Reb Meir and the Chachamim were having all kinds of problems understanding the machlokas, Reb Meir and the Chachamim, if a litigant can disqualify the other litigant's judges, and then the discussion can he disqualify the litigant's witnesses. And we started talking about, well, maybe it's speaking to the case where he's willing to do something beyond what he's required to, and then he wants to back out of it, if you recall. So now we're going to get to the primary Mishnah that talks about where the guy wants to accept more than he should, and then he wants to back out of it, where we clearly see a machlokas Reb Meir and the Chachamim. So, remember we said, relatives are not eligible to be judges. People who have done certain averis are not eligible to be judges. But remember, if the litigants both agree to accept their verdict, you can. If you're willing to let, you know, my relative be the judge, you're willing, then it's okay. Now, this is where Shelley had a little trouble, but look at the footnote in 30, gives you the reason. Because any stipulation made between two parties concerning monetary matters is binding. Since a person is free to give away his money, his willingness to abide by a ruling rendered by normally ineligible judges is acceptable. So if you say, listen, I'm going to have my father judge us, and if the other guy's saying, okay, but yeah, he's my father, you know, he might take, well, I don't care, okay, you're allowed to do it, right? So that's what we're going to be speaking about. We're going to speak where one of the litigants will allow a normally not acceptable judge, he says it's acceptable. And then the question is, can you back out of it? And this is clearly, in this Mishnah, written clearly, a machlokas Reb Meir in the Chachamim over here. So let's take a look at the Mishnah. Amar lo, if one litigant declared to his opponent, Neman alai abba, it's acceptable for me that my father act as a judge, which normally can, it's a relative, or the opposite, Nemar levich, or I trust your father can be the judge. Or another example of normally not acceptable judges, Neman alai shlosha rea bakar, three cattle herders are acceptable as judges, and we know that cattle herders are generally not Torah scholars. So any one of three cases which are normally, you don't have to accept them as judges, normally they're disqualified without question. So we gave an example of relatives and examples of non-scholars. Now, though he agreed, can he back out of it? Now, the Gemara is going to later on discuss at what stage you want to back out. Before they render a ruling, after they render a ruling, that's going to be another discussion later on. But right now, straight off, Reb Meir says, Yochol lachsor bo, you may retract from it. Vechachamim omrim, and the rabbis say, Ein yochol lachsor bo. He is not allowed to retract. Okay, that's the general statement. Now, remember who's saying what, because then it's going to get really tricky if we get into the Gemara. Now, what about another situation? What if hayachayev lechaveru shvua? Let's say a litigant was now obliged to swear an oath in court. Okay? Now, what kind of oath is going to happen here? For Amarlo, and the latter said to the former, the guy who has to make him make the oath, says, you know, you don't have to make such a strong oath. You know, remember, what's a normal oath? We'll see in a minute. The commentator is going to tell, oh, here it is. Normally, how do you make an oath in a court? When someone's obligated to swear a court-imposed oath, he must do so while holding a Torah scroll and was mentioned the name of God as part of the oath. Now, that's serious business, okay? In the case of our Mishnah, we're going to say it's a little bit different over here. Guys, one guy is saying, you got to make an oath to me. Let's say you owe me money. I don't. Well, swear. I'm demanding from you an oath. And you give the oath, you don't have to pay. Now, normally, I can demand an oath. You're going to hold a Torah scroll. You're going to swear by Hashem's name, which is serious business. What if I say, you know, even if you can make a small oath, not such a big oath, you don't got to say God's name, you could say some other things. You know, then can I back out of that? So look what he's saying. Reuven says like this, I swear by the life of my head that my claim is the correct one. You don't have to hold a Sefer Torah. You don't have to say Hashem's name. It's a much smaller one. And that's what it says. Dor li b'chaye roshcha. Swear to me by the life of your head, and I'll accept it. Now, can you back out and change your mind? And the guy says, okay, I will. So then Reb Meir Omer, yochel achzer bo. You could back out and say, no, I changed my mind. I want you to do it with Hashem's name. Chamim Omerim, the rabbis say, ein yochel achzer, you cannot retract from that. Okay. Let's go back to the first case where I initially accept that a not qualified judge can preside. So now we're going to have a two or three way machlokas in what the Chachamim and Reb Meir argue about. All we have in the Mishnah, the only words we have is if the guy says, "I will believe your judges, which are not normally accepted." Then Reb Meir says he could back out and say, no, I changed my mind. I don't want to take them. He doesn't have to. Chacham say, no, you said you're going to take them. You got to take them. Now, you have to know there's two kinds of court cases. Well, it's one kind, but a litigant can find himself in one of two places in a court case. In a monetary case, what are the two positions a litigant can be in? One is he is trying to extract money out of one. I believe that's called the plaintiff, mm-hmm. right? And the other side is, they want to take from you, you're the defendant. So now the Gemara is going to discuss, when the guy says, I want to back out, under which type of court case scenario is he saying, I'm willing to take a poor judge, and then he wants to back out? Is it a case, now let's think for a minute, where he's the defendant or the plaintiff? Which one would you more likely want to say there's more leniency to back out of? You understand what we're talking about? When there's two litigants, always one is the plaintiff, one is the defendant. One wants to extract money, and the other guy is trying to avoid paying money. Mm-hmm. So the question is, when we have this machlokas, is it by the plaintiff and not by the defendant, or vice versa, or both? Where is this machlokas where the plaintiff, can he back out or not back out, but maybe the defendant not? So let's think, where would you assume when the guy says, well, I'm willing to have him be the judge on me, so even though he's not such a good judge, where would we more likely say the guy could back out? So let's see. So now this is where we're getting a three, potentially, to two and a half way machlokas. There's two clear statements. This is, remember, Americhim are Tanoim. Amoroim are trying to analyze in which case do they argue and which case don't they argue, or maybe they always argue. So two positions are clear. A third one is not clear, and that's where the Gemara is going to debate what's the third position saying over here. So let's take it slow. Amar Rav Dimi, Breder Rav Nachman, Breder Rav Yosef. Rav Dimi, the son of Rav Nachman, the son of Yosef, says, the first line is just a simple line. We're going to get to machlokes in a minute. First line is just straight. Kagon de kavlechad. First of all, we're talking an instance where the litigant accepted one of these judges as only one of the three judges. Remember, you have to have three judges. If the guy accepts one, then we have this machlokes. Look at the footnote. He did not waive the requirement that three judges try the case. He merely agreed to allow the ineligible father to be one of them. In other words, there's a lot of things you could be waiving in a case. When you have, what's a normal monetary case supposed to be? Three judges. That's the normal norm for a monetary case. If a guy, I want to take you to court, I could say, well, we're going to have three judges. And normally, no relatives and no wicked people. Okay? Now, in our case, it seemed that what was the litigant waiving? Just one thing, that I let your relative or an unlearned person be the judge, right? So the Mishnah is, so this Rabbi Dimi, the son of Nachman, son of Yosef, qualifies. We're only speaking where only one thing was waived by the litigant, which is what? One of the judges can be an improper judge. The guy did not waive the idea you have to have three judges. We're not saying where he waived, you know, you don't even need three judges. We don't have one judge. He can even be your father. And then question, he wants to back out on all that. No, we're speaking in a case where the overall requirement of three, he's not waiving that. He's just saying, well, one of the three could be not such a great judge. So even so, okay, so he only agreed for one thing. Even so, Reb Meir maintains that the litigant may rescind his waiver. Because, now, he may certainly do so if, in addition, he had agreed to allow the father to serve in place of two or all three judges. If he says, oh, just let your father be the judge, we don't need any more judges. So Reb Meir for sure would say that. For such a great waives more than one requirement. And here's the idea. The more requirements waived, the more subject to retraction the agreement is. Mm-hmm. In other words, when I'm offering you the moon, I could take it away. I'll let you only do one judge. It could be your father. Whoa, you're giving me everything. You know, I changed my mind. I don't want to do that. Okay, you can change your mind when you're giving him so much. The rabbis, on their hand, you see their strictness. They rule the litigant may not renege on his agreement even where two or more requirements were waived. They're going to argue and say, even if you waived everything, you can't back out of it. So that's how extreme the machlokas is, according to the commentaries. You understand? Reb Meir is saying, even if I only waived one thing, I can back out of it. The rabbi said, even if you waived everything, you can't back out of it. So that's the extremes of that. That was just one qualifying statement. No issues with that. That's simple. Now we're coming, the fun and games begin. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. This is the first Amora here. Amar Shmuel says, Machlokas, the machlokas between Reb Meir and the Chachamim is only in a case of bimocholoch, in the case where the plaintiff declares to the defendant, the money I claim is forgiven to you if the court decides in your favor. In other words, the plaintiff's the one who says, I'll let your father be the judge. He's the litigant who is allowing to relax the rules. That's when there's a machlokas. Look at the commentary. It is in this case that the sages rule that the plaintiff may not retract his agreement. Why not? He says like this, for now, it's a very interesting thing, for no formal kinyan act of acquisition is required to effect the waiver of a debt. Because what's the issue over here? When the plaintiff takes the guy to court, one or two things can happen. Either he wins, and the money's coming to him, or he loses. Now, if he loses, what's really happening? Let's say the guy owed him the money. But the fact is, once you lose the case, you don't need any kinyan for the guy to waive the debt. Thus, if the court fines for the debtor doesn't have to pay. He automatically acquires the money by virtue of its being in his possession. Right, there's a question whose money this is. Right, the plaintiff says you owe me $100. It's my money. I lent you $100. I told you to watch $100 for me. And now, if we rule with the defendant, that's the debtor, right? So what happens? Well, he has the money. It's there. Nothing. No transfer happens. He holds on to what he has. So in that case, the rabbis say the plaintiff may not retract his agreement. Okay, if you are willing to let the guy hold on to the money if he wins, then they say you can't back out of that, while Reb Meir says you could still back out of it. Aval, that's when there's a machlokas. Aval be'etain lecha. But if it's the defendant who says, I'll give you the money if I lose, is the other hand now, the defendant who's allowing that thing to happen, divrei hakol, everybody agrees, yochol lachzor bo, he can back out of it. Why? Because this is an issue of him having to give the money. So even the rabbis would concede that the defendant may retract, for no kinyan has been performed to bind him to his verbal agreement. The court's ruling by itself does not obligate him to pay, because only a court composed of three qualified judges has the power to extract money. In other words, what happens, think about it. When a court makes a ruling, they got a lot of power. Three guys say you own the money, and by virtue of that, money goes out of my pocket and goes into that guy's pocket. Well, that's a pretty powerful thing over here. So for that much power to happen, so even the Chacham would agree, if the guy wants to back out of it, he can back out of it, and he could say that it's not binding anymore, that I shouldn't have to pay any money. But if it's on the other hand, where the guy says, okay, where it's the plaintiff and the plaintiff says, I'll accept someone else, so then nothing really happens because there's no real movement of money. Okay? In other words, does the Besdin statement make something happen or not? Okay? You understand? In other words, it was just a verbal agreement. What did I say? I verbally said that if I lose, you could have the money. Was there any Kenyan there? Was there any Kenyan made? Was there any mode of acquisition made when he verbally says, if I lose, you know, I'll accept the that thing? No. Right? So that can't make him pay. Only when there's qualified judges. And this was not a qualified judge. So the Chacham would agree, you can back out if you are the what? The defendant. But if it's a question of the plaintiff doesn't need any Kenyan. Again, gives the right of a Besdin to take money out of somebody? Because Torah gives a Besdin a power that when they rule, that is like the Kenyan, like that they're able to take it out. Right? Now, obviously, if we waive the rights and say one judge doesn't have to be a real judge, so the money isn't moving because of the force of the decision. It's moving because I'm willing to lose it. Mm-hmm. So the fact that I'm just saying I'm willing to lose it, I can change my mind. I didn't make any Kenyan. So when I'm the defendant, even the Chachamim would agree that you could back out of it because there was no Kenyan made. On the other hand, if you're the plaintiff, and the plaintiff says, you know, I want to take the money from you, and if I lose, I'm willing to let them have it, so nothing happens. So I don't need. And so there, where the rabbis would argue and say, well, you can't back out of there because it's not even the Besdin's ruling doesn't do anything. The Besdin's ruling isn't pulling any money out from A to B. You understand? So if you're just willing, you're the plaintiff, and you're willing to let the guy have his relative rule on that case, so, and if he rules, he rules, and, you know, so nothing really happens. So the rabbis say, so let it stay as it is. Let it stay as it is, and you can't change your mind. And there's no Kenyan being made because there's no transfer happening. Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Meir, argues and says, no, even in that case, you can back out. So clear. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, the machlokas is only in a case where it's the, the plaintiff. When the plaintiff wants to waive it, then you have a machlokas. But if it's the defendant, then even the Chachamim agree you can nullify it. Clear? That's opinion number one. Now, opinion number two is the tricky part. Because Rabbi Yehuda Shmuel said the whole thing, said both halves. Rabbi Yehuda Shmuel said the machlokes is by the plaintiff and not by the defendant. Look what Rabbi Yochanan says. Rabbi Yochanan Omar, he says, Be'etain lecha machlokes. The machlokes is by the defendant. That's when there's a machlokes. Now, he didn't say anything else. He's not telling us what about if we were the case with a plaintiff. Now, is it maybe also machlokas? Right? He just says, or maybe no, there's no machlokas, and maybe everybody agrees in a case of a plaintiff that even Reb Meir would agree you can't back out. Maybe that's what. So it's not clear what Reb Yochanan is saying. All he is saying is, well, I can tell you this, there's a machlokas when the defendant wants to waive his right. That's when there's a machlokas, can you back out? What about if there is a plaintiff? Didn't say. Sana Gemara is not sure what Rabbi Yochanan means over here. So Ibailo, Gemara is a Shaila. Do we say, Be'etan lecha machlokas, when you're the defendant, there's a machlokas. And now, do we imply, Avo b'mochalach, but when it's a question of being moichal, being, when the plaintiff would forego on it, Divrei Kol Ein Yochalach Zero, will everybody agree, you can't back out because now there's nothing, no kinyan being made? Or maybe he meant, oh, Dilma, or maybe Bein Bezu Machlo, maybe it's a Machlokas in both cases. So we're not sure what Rabbi Yochanan said regarding the plaintiff case. Is it also a Machlokas? Or no, everyone will agree that you cannot back off because there's no Kenyan necessary. You got the Gemara Shaila? Okay, Gemara wants to answer it as follows. Toshma, come in here. To Omar Rava. Now Rava comes along. Rava comes along and says, Machlokes be'etin l'cha. The machlokes is by the defendant. If the defendant waives it, if I'd have to give it to you, if I lose, aval b'machalach, but by machalach, when it's the plaintiff, divrei hakol ein yochalach serbo. Everyone agrees you can't back out. Okay, so what do you see now? You see clearly Rabbi Yehuda, the name of Shmuel, and Rava clearly argue where the machlokas is. Extreme. See the extreme machlokas? Rabbi Yehuda and Shmuel, he says the machlokas is by the plaintiff, but by the defendant, everybody agrees, you can't back out. Rava says the machlokas is by the defendant, but by the plaintiff, everybody agrees, you can't back out. So wait a minute. So these are two clear Amorite positions. Now, we had a Shiloh, what does Rabbi Yochanan hold, right? What does Rabbi Yochanan hold? He only said one thing. He only said, by which case? What did Rabbi Yochanan say by? By the plaintiff, right? Rabbi Yochanan be'etin. No, he only said by the defendant. Be'etin lochot. By the defendant. But he didn't say by the plaintiff. So now we have two ways of looking at it. So let's see. Iyamr bishlema, if you're going to say that be'etin lochot machlokas, only by the defendant there's a machlokas, avol b'mochol lochot, but when you're the plaintiff, divrei hakol ein yochalach, you can't back off. Ah, very good. So Rabbi Yochanan would be just like Rava. Rava, the Amak Rabbi Yochanan. Rava would be saying like Rabbi Yochanan, because then it would be very well fitting. But if you're going to say, they argue in both cases, Eliyamet Bezu Bezu Machlokes, you're going to say they're arguing here, they're arguing here, so it's going to be pretty difficult. Rava, the Amak, who's Rava holding like? He doesn't hold neither like Shmuel or Rabbi Yochanan. So it must be, it means, he said, they don't argue by that. Because it's very unlikely that Rava would say the machlokas is different than Rehuda or Shmuel and Rabbi Yochanan say the machlokas. You follow? He said, in other words, if you're going to say that they argue in both cases, then who's Rava saying the machlokas? He's not agreeing with Rehuda or Shmuel, he's not agreeing with Rabbi Yochanan. So I don't know why the Gemara held up such a kash, because look at the answer. Rava, time it adoption cover. Good. Rava stating his own position, a third position. So now it comes out, we have three different ways of learning the machlokas. The extremes. Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel says the machlokas is only when it's the plaintiff. When the plaintiff comes along and is willing to forego it, then there's a machlokas. But by the defendant, you can surely back out because you want to take the money away from him. That's the way he learns it. Rava is the, let's see now. Rava is the extreme the other way, and saying the machlokas is by the plaintiff and by the defendant, everyone agrees you can't back out. And then we have Rabbi Yochanan, who may very well say there's a machlokas in both cases. It's a machlokas in both cases. And therefore, there's three different ways to learn the machlokas. All right, we'll stop over there, let you digest this. Morris then going to ask a question on this. Okay, we'll review this a little bit tomorrow. But that, come, you see three ways to learn it? Yeah. So that's three possible ways to learn the machlokas, and Morris is going to have kashas on it. So let's just try to digest this part.
So macholecha is the plaintiff, and etan
macholecha is plaintiff means macho. I'm macho. Yeah. I'm macho. You don't have to pay me.
Exactly.
Etan lecha means no. I'm going to have to give you.
Exactly.
The defendant has to give. The plaintiff can be macho. Exactly. That's if they lose.
Okay.
All right. All righty. A little bit tricky today.